This is KBOO Portland, and we continue with the incomparable Radio Zine. This next segment features KBOO's own Ken Jones, featuring writer who will be appearing at the upcoming Northwest Book Festival. Check it out.
Welcome to another edition of Radio Zine here on KBOO Community Radio. I'm Ken Jones. Our in-studio guest this morning is author and indie publisher Dan Armstrong. Dan will be appearing at the 8th Annual Northwest Book Festival, which takes place tomorrow in Portland's Pioneer Courthouse Square. Dan's here to give us a preview of the festival. We'll also cover the nuts and bolts of independent publishing, the challenges facing the DIY author, and a bit about Dan's own work. This includes the first two books of The Eyes of Archimedes, a trilogy about the famous Greek mathematician and his slave during the rise of Rome circa 200 BC. You can meet Dan and a host of other Pacific Northwest authors tomorrow at the festival, which runs from 11 a.m. to 5 p.m. Again, it's in Pioneer Courthouse Square, and admission is free. Dan Armstrong, thanks very much for being here at KBOO today.
Ken, thank you for having me. It's a great pleasure.
Dan, you'll be appearing tomorrow Saturday, as we mentioned, at the Northwest Book Festival, now in its 8th year. Can you tell us a little bit about the festival?
Well, I've attended last year, and then I attended 3 years earlier. So I've been to, this will be the 3rd out of 8. It's a very nice festival in that it focuses on writing. Often I do book festivals that the focus is many other things. But this is authors and publishers, and for an independent publisher like myself, it's a really nice place to get a chance to talk to the public. And most of the writers there will be independent. There'll be a few others, but they'll be primarily independent authors.
Oh, I should add, there'll actually be over 100 authors at the festival, all in Pioneer Square. So actually, for our listeners who are big readers, it's this incredible opportunity. Also, in terms of weather, it's hot today, but it's supposed to be about 10 degrees cooler tomorrow. Should be perfect.
And last year, it rained all day.
Oh, okay.
But there'll be,
I don't think that's in the works this
70
year.
Booths, and a lot of authors will share a booth. Also, there'll be small publishing companies that are local, Portland, or around the area that will bring several of their authors, and they'll all be in the booth. I think for readers, it's particularly fun because most of these people you won't have heard of. And you'll see a lot of different books, and you get to ask them about it. I think that's a really nice part of the entire festival is actually talking to the writers.
And I would think they'd all be very happy to sign the books that are purchased.
Absolutely. They're dying to sell their books. You know, it's a tough business being an independent author, and opportunities like these are not easy. You're hawking your book, basically pitching it to one customer at a time. And, you know, you may talk to 100 people, you may talk to 150 people, and maybe you sell 15 books.
What's a typical interaction? Say I came up to your booth tomorrow and I said, oh, this looks interesting. Mud City Press, what's going on here?
Well, if the question came out about Mud City Press, I would say the website was designed as a way to launch my books in 2007 when I began doing the independent publishing. And I tied it. My writing is really broken into two pieces. I do fiction and nonfiction, and the fiction are the novels. That's what I've been publishing. But I've also done a lot of environmental writing. And in particular, Mud City Press has a lot of articles about sustainable agriculture, and it's focused on the Willamette Valley. And that was really that opened all of this up. My first novel that I published myself is called Prairie Fire. And I did not know the farm community at that point. I'd been writing about the environment, and I say farm community, the local farm community. And the novel itself, Prairie Fire, is a kind of a Tom Clancy type novel, many layers, many characters going on all at once. It's a long book, but it's centered on the grain market, the commodities market. And rather than having the crisis of an atomic bomb going off or a stolen jet, I have this. The world trigger is really the grain market.
A food shortage?
Yeah, well, yes. In this case, it's a drought in China. And not to go into tremendous detail on that, but China is the second largest producer of wheat in the world next to us. And if their own harvest is less than, is dropped by 20%, in other words, if they have 80% of their normal harvest, that's enough to completely dislodge the grain market. Their 20% of their market is more than is available on the export market. So,
and the book kind of presumes that type of situation.
The book is actually a two-part book. The second part is Taming the Dragon, which is set in China, and Prairie Fire is set in the United States. Taming the Dragon is set at the Three Gorges Dam, and it's on a year where the snowpack in the Himalayas is down by about 15 or 20%. Doesn't sound like a lot, but it would impact the water supply in China, and that's the trigger that sets off a grain crisis in China in the imagined year. It's a couple of years from now. So Taming the Dragon approaches the grain crisis in China from the dynamics of this giant dam and how the low water flow in the Yangtze impacts the dam. I won't go on any other detail in that. However, on the other side of the world, in the United States, where the grain market has not been impacted by this diminishment of the snowpack in Southeast Asia, but the price jumps from a normal $3.50 to $4 a bushel to $12 a bushel in July. This actually happened in 2008. If anyone remembers, the price of petroleum went up to $150 a bushel, and the price of grain hit $12 a bushel, both exceedingly...
A barrel of petroleum, right.
Pardon me. And essentially tripling the prices. Well, the idea in the two books is a little thing, well, maybe it's not so little, a diminishment in the snowpack in the Himalayas could actually impact, how does it impact the world on the other side? In the case of American farmers, which is what Prairie Fire is about, they usually sell their wheat as futures to finance their planting. In other words, they may take the January or the February price of wheat, they make a deal on that, and then they use that money to plant and harvest, run through the season. And then at the end of the year, presumably they've gotten more money out of it than they started with if their harvest is good. However, if the price of wheat would go up to $12 in July, and they're getting ready to harvest, they're not going to get that $12 a bushel. They're going to get that $4. So in the story, the farmers decide that they're upset with the dynamics of the market, and they say that they will burn 1 million acres of wheat every Monday until they get another dollar per bushel on their harvest. So this amounts to a standoff between the industry, the grain industry, and the farmers. And on a Monday morning, they burn 1 million acres of wheat. And if you've ever seen the acreage numbers on a wildfire, they're usually way, way less than 1 million. However, that represents less than 1% of all the entire wheat harvest. And so imagine waking up one morning and turning on your TV to CNN and seeing that 1 million acres of wheat is on fire all across the southern portion of the United States. This then sends the Dow into a tailspin, and the commodities market goes through the roof. And
this is all kind of the speculation in the book, what would happen.
This is what's happening in the book. So okay. What happens is the National Guard is called out. The farmers are pushed off their own land because they don't want the wheat burnt or set aflame. And wheat happens to be one of our national security elements. Mm-hmm. The Middle East might have petroleum, but we grow wheat and grain. That would be corn and all sorts of rye, barley, oats. And it's also, this all happens in the middle of a presidential election year. So the president in this case is trying to decide how does he maneuver this field burning episode to his political advantage.
Dan, I wanted to kind of return to the event here.
Absolutely.
Pardon me. We'll go over some of the Mud City Press books. And in fact, the two latest ones I'm very interested in hearing about. That, and you'll have Prairie Fire and Taming the Dragon at the event tomorrow. I was interested in whether you kind of network, talk with the other authors at the festival and exchange notes about what it's like to be an independent publisher.
Yes, of course. There's a lot of time where you're talking to people. People, the festival attendees are milling around, and you're often maybe 2 or 3 feet away from someone else. And we're always trying to trade ideas. What are you doing to get your work out? What is your publishing system? Who are you using?
Are those the main challenges, would you say?
The main challenge is PR, definitely, for an independent publisher like myself. And an interview like this on KBOO is one of the things that's very important to me. So, again, thank you, Ken.
Thank you for coming in. And of course, the Northwest Book Festival and festivals like it.
Right, exactly. And those are some of the easiest things to do. But that's where I get, that's what you want to talk about with the other authors. How do you get your name out? What other book festivals are you going to? Whatever other types of events do you go to?
And what about the feedback from your readers and potential readers? Do you kind of take that in and then use that in writing some of your future fiction or the stuff you're working on now?
Well, yes.
Of course, it's too late to revise a book that's already out and printed. But
well, that's actually not even that. I mean, that's the one thing about a print-on-demand book. Now, when you're sitting at the table, often people will come by that have bought your books before, and more often than not, they're going to compliment you. I haven't had anybody come up to me and say anything negative about a book, but they often tell you you like it. And in my case, that personal connection is important. Sometimes they may ask you a question about the book or maybe something that they didn't understand. And you can actually go back to the book and make a change. And this is what's sort of fortunate about the print-on-demand. If I were to publish a book and a person came up to my booth tomorrow and said, I found 4 typos in your book, and this is where they are, these are the pages, I could literally, within 48 hours, make those corrections and have the book on sale corrected.
Oh, yeah, definitely typos, but I meant in terms of...
Even an idea.
An idea. So what if I came up and said, man, I love Prairie Fire, but what a lame ending.
Well... Okay,
and this is just pure theoretical. I don't believe that.
It depends how long it's been out. Chances are I won't change it.
Right.
If it's only been out a little while, if the book has been out 3 weeks, I would consider it, because chances are in 3 weeks only 10 or 15 people would have read it. Mm. It's rare. I have had that kind of comment made, and never have I made a major change.
Well, that's really kind of, I think, up to the author and their creative prerogative.
Exactly.
And readers can weigh in however they like, I would think. In terms of any experience you've had at the Northwest Book Festival or similar festivals, are there any in particular that stand out for you?
Well, I think most of the best things are actually the personal engagements. Maybe another author or someone that stops by. But at the... Art in the Vineyard Book Festival and Wine Tasting event in Eugene, Oregon, I sat all day next to Ken Babbs. And that was probably one of the most fun days I had. If you know who Ken Babbs, one of the Merry Pranksters.
Yeah, big colleague of Ken Kesey.
Close friend of Ken Kesey. And Ken Babbs was also in the William Stegner Writing Program with Ken Kesey.
At Stanford.
At Stanford. And we talked a lot about that, because I had applied to that when I was much younger and I hadn't gotten in. And we spoke a little bit about that. And his particular class included Ken Kesey, Ken Babbs, Sandra Day O'Connor.
I didn't know she started as a writer.
Wendell Berry.
Uh-huh.
And Edward Abbey.
Oh.
So what a class of writers all in the same group. And... that was a very fun exchange, and Ken Babbs is extremely fun.
And he told you some
guy.
Stories about the writing class.
He told me stories about the writing class, and he told me stories about the Merry Pranksters, and in particular his brother, who had died a couple of years prior to my meeting Ken, who was one of the Merry Pranksters too. And I think his favorite story was about when the Merry Pranksters played the Eugene Police Department in a basketball game at South Eugene High School. And us just say at halftime they had some, what would we call it, mine enhancers to improve their game. And
the little boxes of juice that they handed out, huh, were spiked.
They defeated the Eugene Police Department. So that's pretty fun.
Oh, if you just tuned in, you're listening to Radio Zine on KBOO Community Radio, and we're talking with author and indie publisher Dan Armstrong. Dan will be appearing at the Northwest Book Festival this Saturday, that's tomorrow, in Portland's Pioneer Courthouse Square. The festival goes from 11 a.m. to 5 p.m., and admission is free. Dan, we talked about the event itself, the book festival. I wanted to get more into Mud City Press now, and you mentioned starting it with the book Prairie Fire. How did you decide to start your own press? Why the name Mud City? And did you, here's a kind of a multi-question, I guess. Did you originally shop Prairie Fire and the book around to agents and more established publishers?
So, yes, I did. I shopped it around, and it was a political book. And then that was kind of the reason for Mud City Press, which the name comes from Spencer's Butte, Skinner's Butte in Eugene. The landing there about 1850 used to be called Mud City. So I live in Eugene. Mud City Press is appropriate. Anyone that lives in the Northwest gets used to the mud and the rain. So, and I thought it had a kind of a lighthearted sound to it, although my work is generally not that lighthearted. But in the case, why did I start it? I had tried several publishers and several agents with Prairie Fire, and I was getting a lot of interest, but the political nature of the story was difficult. And I realized that I wanted more control of what I was doing, and I also was, particularly in the political realm, I might not be able to find a publisher that wanted to do it. The title Prairie Fire comes from the work from the Weather Underground, if right. anyone's familiar with that, and it probably triggered all of the NSA telephone lines and email lines when I wrote about this. But in any case...
Was that the feedback you were getting then? We'd love to publish it, but we're a little kind of freaked out by the possible security implications.
That aspect, and another thing that I think independent publishers or independent writers discover is publishing houses want to do genre material. They want a niche and they want a place for it. And often writers don't fall into those niches, or they don't want to go into them. And that was one of my things. My agent that I had in the 90s kept saying, Dan, you know, you've got three genres represented in your book. And she says, I'm finding it very entertaining, but I'm not going to be able to find a publisher because they're not going to know where to put it. And so that's
making it hard to market. And
making it hard to market. And a lot of writers are like that. And I think that's a good reason to go to print on demand or independent printing. But in the case of Mud City Press, it was a kind of a fortuitous situation. I put out Prairie Fire in 2007. And decided that the website, if I included the environmental task angle with the book, they tied together. And I was writing a lot about food security, local food, sustainable farming. But I was not an experienced in it. I was a reader. I had studied it. And when I put Prairie Fire out, I gave it to a couple of local farmers in the Willamette Valley, and they really liked it. And it is, and I kind of got instant farm cred from these farmers. And we began the other side.
But by instant farm cred, you mean that
they respected what I knew.
And gave you more information. And
They would talk to me. They would open up. One farmer bought 15 copies and gave it to all her friends. And the topic, this is a big story, so I'm going to try to cut it short. I was writing about the grain market. And when I finished the book, I went and started studying grain production in the Willamette Valley. And I discovered that as recently as 1970, we were producing a lot of wheat in the Willamette Valley. And in 2006, 2007, we were producing almost none. We had become the grass seed capital of the world. And instead of doing food, we were doing grass seed. And in that turndown, I was talking about 2007, 2008, the high price of petroleum and the high price of wheat, I became part of a group called the Southern Willamette Valley Bean and Grain Project. And our effort was to go out to the grass seed farmers and introduce grains and dry beans to them as a way to diversify their farm model. This actually turned into a tremendously successful project.
So all as a result of publishing this first novel, Prairie Fire.
The project would have started on its own, but what happened is I was already tuned in when I met the man that started it, Harry McCormick, my good friend, and they needed a writer, and they said, what we need is a narrative. And so I became the narrator for this project for 8 years, and if you go to Mud City Press, the entire thing is on there, 20 articles. Every quarter, I would write a piece about what was happening, and I think if anybody hasn't heard of this, check it out. It's you know, in terms of food security, local reliance, self-reliance, resiliency. This is an important thing to do.
And we should mention that the Mud City Press, can you give the website to the listeners?
It's www.mudcitypress.com.
All one word, mudcitypress.com. And you'll find, you'll be able to buy, there's 7 books available now there, all by Dan, for purchase. And also, as he mentioned, some of his nonfiction articles on sustainability, peak oil, climate change, nutrition, food, agriculture. In terms of operating the independent press, you started as a writer, of course, and that's your main passion. And yet, as an independent publisher, you have to wear many hats. You're a writer, editor, publisher, marketeer, PR person. Was it difficult to learn these roles and take them on?
Well, the writing, of course, I was already doing, and editing is a big part of it, and I had been doing that. I worked as an editor in New York City in the 80s. The hard part was the PR. I am not a naturally, I don't really like to sit down and talk about how great my stuff is.
I think you share that with a lot of writers, that part of your
personality. Regardless of what I might feel, in any case. So the PR has been very difficult for me. The other pieces came naturally, the writing, the organizing. I like to do the graphics in the website. I've done all of the graphics, the artwork. It's fun for me. It's a great break from the writing. But the PR, again, is very hard. These book festivals, this radio interview, that's where I try to go. I have not invested a lot of money in PR, and maybe that's something I need to do. I guess I got to get wealthy.
Oh, well.
Selling books.
I'd like to get to some of the other books. Actually, the latest Mud City Press books are the first two parts of a trilogy, which I mentioned in the intro to the program. The Eyes of Archimedes is the name of the trilogy. Can you tell us a little bit about this? I mentioned that it's about, the great mathematician Archimedes. He has a slave who narrates the books and takes place around 200 BC.
That's right. So in a nutshell, what we do is we follow the life of a young Greek boy who starts, he's 13 years old at the beginning of the book, and we follow him through his life till he's 26, and that's the extent of the war. So we're really getting the impact of the war on a young boy. Now, what makes the boy special is his father was a geometer and he knew math. And in the course of the war, he's kidnapped and put into slavery, and he's sold to Archimedes.
He spends Archimedes picks up that this is a very intelligent kid.
That's right. So Archimedes, he then becomes essentially an apprentice. Now, I won't go into the rest of it, but the first story is set in a Greek colony, Syracuse, on the island of Sicily. It tells the story of the siege of Syracuse of early in the war.
And that's the name of the book,
the Siege of Syracuse. That's the name of the book. Most people don't even know that Archimedes really played a part in the Second Punic War. That's the war between Rome and Carthage, the war where Hannibal came through the Alps with the elephants. It's very, very huge, important war in the history of Western civilization.
What was that part that he played then? He designed the weapons?
He designed weapons, and he was kind of like a Wernher von Braun of the Second Punic War. In other words, he was the most advanced scientist. He was making the most advanced weapons. And when Rome...
Kind of the V2 rocket of that age.
Absolutely. No, exactly. And that was one of the reasons I wrote it. I have a background in science. And when Archimedes dies at the end of the book, this is not news, so I'm not breaking the drama, but Greek science essentially stops at his death. And we will not reach his level of sophistication in math and geometry until the 1600s, until Galileo, until Kepler, until Copernicus. These are people that will start doing the science that Archimedes was doing, and 1800 years have passed.
Oh, that's amazing.
So it's a loss.
He was that important a figure.
He was that important and that far advanced, and that's in the book. I try not to make it a science book, but we have the young man, the slave, learning that. The second book is set in Rome. And again, the idea is to involve myself in the culture of Rome and what Rome is like in 200 BC. And the third book takes place in Africa and Carthage. And I attempt to explore the culture of North Africa and the culture of the Phoenician colony Carthage. So I have three books, three different cities, three different cultures, and all narrated to a young man who's learning about it and also being impacted by the war.
No, clearly the trilogy tells a great story. Archimedes is this amazing historical figure, especially in the history of science, extremely significant there. You have characters like the Roman general Marcellus. You have Hannibal, who's conquering the world here. Did you have reasons to set the books in this period over 2,000 years ago? And I was wondering, do you see parallels of that time with our current situation?
Two-part question. The first, I'll answer the second part first. Absolutely, and especially in the case of the second book where I'm in Rome, and Rome is a military state. And I do try to run parallels to what's happening now. I try to make the books have a contemporary relevance. And so the answer is yes. I won't go into the details, but we're going to run out of time. The answer to the other question is, when I began the research to this work, which was in 1990, I realized I had to read the classics. This would be Livy, Polybius, the Greek literature, Greek writers, Roman writers.
What was the spark of the idea then that got you involved and you turned to the classics at that point?
I picked up, my grandfather died in 1988 and he left me his books and he left me a set of Plutarch. So I had these three books sitting in my library in my office, and one afternoon I picked up the first volume of Plutarch. I opened the book to the story of Marcellus. I read this book and I said, this is such a cool story. So many fascinating features. And in the center of it was Archimedes, having the most sophisticated catapults in the world, having built defenses for Syracuse that no one could get in. It's just a fabulous, fabulous story. And I said, one day I'm going to write this story. And when I sat down to do it, I realized my history was lacking. And I read Livy, which is a Roman author, Roman historian. And I'm thinking, oh, boy, I'll open up this book, and it's going to be just drudgery to get through 400 pages. It turned out to be a massively fun book, not necessarily easy, but just one adventure story after another. And I would say that when I inscribe my books, I say, revisit the classics. The classics used to be the center of 19th century education.
There's still schools like that. I think St. John's in Arizona or New Mexico. And in other words, the great books.
The great books, right. But in general, we're not reading them. And if you mention the classics, people don't even know what they are. I'd say anything written prior to 200 AD falls into the classics, Roman or Greek literature. And the Second Punic War, which was my focus, used to be one of the central stories that was taught in high school in almost every place. And every student knew who Hannibal was, and every student knew this story. And
today, less and less, apparently.
Today, all they know is the elephants. And I'll try to sell a book. I'll say, Second Punic War. What's that?
Yeah, what's that?
Hannibal coming through
the Alps.
I
missed the first one.
Oh, yes, right. No.
So those two books will be available tomorrow at the 8th Annual Northwest Book Fair. And that's the Siege of Syracuse, the first volume, The Death of Marcellus II, and The Eyes of Archimedes. Dan, when's the third volume in the trilogy coming out? And what's the name of that when you mentioned Africa?
Third book is called Zama, battle between Hannibal and Scipio, the Roman general that defeats him. That's the last battle, and it'll be out in September. And I will say to anyone that's listening, if you stop by the festival tomorrow and you say that you heard me on the radio, I will give you a $5 discount on the Siege of Syracuse, and that will be the first five people. And
so it starts at 11. You might want to get there early.
Right.
Dan, I wanted we have to wrap up, but I wanted to thank you very much for coming into KBOO today, this morning, and we look forward to seeing you tomorrow at the 8th Annual Northwest Book Fair.
Well, I think the thanks should be mine to you. I really appreciate you having me in here. And while I have this opportunity, I'm going to throw a little hi out to a friend of mine, Tyler. I hope he's listening.
Tyler, hello to you too, and thanks, Dan, for coming in. We've been talking with author and indie publisher Dan Armstrong. As we mentioned, Dan will be appearing at the Northwest Book Festival tomorrow. That's Saturday in Portland's Pioneer Courthouse Square. Festival goes from 11 a.m. to 5 p.m., and admission is free, and there'll be over 100 authors there. If you're a big reader as well as a big KBOO listener, it's a great place to go, and a great way to spend a Saturday. I'm Ken Jones, and this has been Radio Zine on KBOO Community Radio. Many thanks to Dan for joining us today, and to all of you for listening.